Joining me today is a very special guest, Jesse Cook, who is a multi-award-winning, internationally acclaimed guitarist, composer, producer, filmmaker, and singer. And he's here today.
Oh, sorry.
And he's here today to talk about his cross-Canada tour, the Tempest 2 tour, and his 11th studio album called Libra. Is that correct?
Libre. Libre, yeah. So it works in Spanish or French or, you know, many Latin languages. So in French, it would be Libre.
Yes.
Spanish, it would be Libre. So it just depends how you want to interpret it.
Yeah.
So I was going to say Libre if you want. I don't care.
I was going to say Libre because the French, but bonjour. Bonjour, Jesse. Yeah. So you were born in Paris, France, and you came to Canada. And I want to know, so who introduced you to flamenco music? Was it your mom, your dad, or both?
I think probably my first connection to flamenco music was my parents' record collection. Like, they had these Manitas Zapatas records. And I should explain to people who, I realize that there's two groups of people. There's people who know nothing about flamenco and, you know, no explanation is required because it's all new, right? But, and then there's people who are, for whom flamenco is a religion, and I should probably sort of go, well, by the way, Manitas Zapatas is, you know, kind of on the edge of flamenco music because he's part of this group of gypsies. Flamenco comes from southern Spain, from Andalusia. And during the Spanish Civil War, a group of gypsies left Spain and relocated to the south of France. And they're not the same as those, you know, Django Reinhardt, Manouche playing gypsies that had been in France for a long time. This was a new group, and they settled around the Camargue and created or produced such artists as Manitas Zapatas, who my parents had these records, who was a fantastic guitarist, and as well as the Gypsy Kings, who, of course, took the world by storm, right? So, but when I was a kid, the Gypsy Kings didn't exist yet, and it was these Manitas Zapatas records that my parents had. I remember I would listen to the record, and the cover of the album was just a big close-up of his hand, and it was like all veiny and muscly, like he'd just been, you know, hammering away on a guitar his whole life. And I thought, oh, I want to do that. That looks really fun. And I got hooked, and then we moved to Canada, as you said, and my first teacher was a flamenco teacher. So it was kind of a weird coincidence. Some of the first pieces I learned on the guitar happened to be flamenco because that was what he taught. And then later, my dad, who had continued to live in Europe, he retired to Arles in the south of France and bought a house next door to Nicolas Reyes, who was the lead singer of the then kind of fledgling up-and-coming group, the Gypsy Kings. And I sort of hung out in Arles and heard that Camargue sound sort of up close with just kids, you know, teenagers walking the streets playing the guitar that way. And so it was like this weird conspiracy, you know, to turn this kind of Canadian kid who should have been listening to Rush into some kind of, you know, flamenco guitarist. So that's the scoop.
Yeah, so you come from a creative side, like filmmakers, fashion photographer, national ballet, ballerina. Was it always music or was it art?
Well, it's interesting. I think I'm the first professional musician in the family. Lots of artists, but I'm the first professional musician. I think most of my family on my mother's side love music and played music for fun, and, you know, like pretty, you know, my cousin was sort of semi-pro, like a Latin percussionist, semi-pro, and my other cousin just, you know, loved to play percussion and banjo and guitar, like just lots of the sort of Boxing Day party every year was just a crazy jamboree with like everybody making music and dancing and stuff. So that was a great place to kind of, if you want to be an artist, it's great to grow up in a family like that, because so many of my friends who became artists come from, you know, families where their parents were unhappy with that decision. You know, there were a lot of kind of doctor parents saying, you know, I'll pay for you to go to university, but not if you're studying music, you're on your own, you know, literally like that. That was something many friends have sort of told me, those stories similar to that. So in my case, my sister actually became a lawyer, and, you know, everybody in the family was shocked. Like, lawyer, what? Oh my God, you know, most parents would be thrilled. And yet somehow in my weird family, that was just seemed so strange.
Yes. And so was there a pivotal moment, Jesse, that, okay, I want to be a musician. Like, can you tell us about that?
So, yeah, I was, you know, when I was a young kid, I was one of those little prodigy kids, you know, that people would trot me out and I'd play and everybody go, oh, wow, amazing. And I studied with the great Ellie Kastner, who was the chairman of the Guitar Association of Canada. And he was a student of Segovia's. And he was kind of, I think he was really hoping that I was going to just become this fantastic classical guitarist. And he wanted me practicing like 3 hours and 4 hours a day. And, you know, I remember sitting in my room practicing and looking out the window and all my friends are outside playing. And I'm going, why do I have to sit here? They all have fun. So when I was about 13, I quit. And I didn't do it for about a year. And when I came back to music, I came back on my own terms and I did whatever I wanted. I played electric guitar. I played in a rock band. I played jazz. I got back into flamenco. And then I just kind of did whatever I wanted for the next, you know, from then on. At the end of high school, I was actually applying to art school. I was thinking I was going to go to Parsons School of Design in New York and become an artist. And my girlfriend in grade 13, back when they had grade 13, my girlfriend said, you know, Jess, your music is really great. And your art's like, you know, you may want to reconsider this life choice, right? And I'm so glad she did, because it really kind of made me put the brakes on. And I ended up taking a year off after grade 13 and just studying music. I went to the conservatory and I studied, you know, harmony, and went and studied piano. And then I studied jazz guitar and just kind of thought, let me just get serious about this and figure out if this is where I want to go. And by the end of that year, I applied to York and did that for a year. And then I ended up at Berkeley in the States. Wow. It was close. Like I honestly think, you know, I don't think I had that, you know, I remember presenting my art at some kind of, you know, one of those school presents things where like they have art, different schools from all over Toronto presenting their best students' artwork. And I was feeling pretty cocky because they'd chosen my artwork to represent my school. And I thought, I'm going to go and see this art exhibit. And I show up and there's my little piece of artwork. And up on the beside it is some insanely amazing hypo-realist, you know, thing the size of a wall, and it looks like, you know, the camera lens is distorted with water on it, and the image itself is photorealistic, but the guy's painted it. And I was just like, okay, I am out of my depth. I could never do that, you know. And so I think it was a, you know, I'm happy with the choice.
You have studied the drums too, right? Is that
growing up in Toronto, you end up doing all sorts of things, you know, for fun. And so I spent a summer studying North Indian tabla with a guy named Pandit Sharda Sahai, who's a sort of the greatest tabla player in the Benares tradition. And he flies, or at the time, he'd kind of descend on Toronto, and all of his disciples would come from all over North America. And I was like, I'd never played tabla in my life. So I had a huge kind of learning curve to catch up, and all these guys who flew in spent the whole day practicing, and I actually still had gigs in the city. I would thought, oh, I'll do it about an hour practicing a day on this, and then I was like, oh my god, this is serious. So that was a sort of steep learning curve, because you know, East Indian rhythm, the philosophy of East Indian rhythm, is the most complex rhythmic kind of system on the planet. But I don't think people realize that, but it really is remarkable what, if you sort of think what Europeans did with rhythm, if you want to kind of equate it with math, it would be like addition, subtraction, and a little bit of multiplication. And then what the Africans did with rhythm would be like algebra, you know, and then what the East Indians did with rhythm is like calculus. Like, it's just so amazing and complex. And that studying it for one summer was just long enough for me to realize, wow, this is huge. I'm either going to dedicate myself to this, or I'm going to, you know, sort of leave it at that. But I joined a West African drumming ensemble for a while. A friend of mine was doing that. He's a master Ghanaian drummer named Joseph Chong. And he was teaching us all his traditional rhythms. And just because he wanted gigs, you know, he arrived in Canada and he wanted to do some gigs. He was looking for musicians. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll learn that stuff. And then another point for fun, I joined a Brazilian samba school, because, you know, that's the beautiful thing in Toronto, or Canada, I should say, is that there are all of these people living here, you know, and communities that are not just one person, but, you know, kind of rich community enough to support mm-hmm. those artists. And so when you're making music that is a kind of a world music big mix, you know, you're in the absolutely the best place. I always think it's funny when I first got a record deal and I went down to Los mm-hmm. Angeles to play the Catalina Jazz Festival, and, you know, all these sort of jazz artists down there from LA are sort of like, so you got a record deal, you're moving to LA now? And I was like, no, why would I do that? And they're like, come on, it's LA, this is where it's happening. And I was like, yeah, I think it's where it's happening for that, the kind of music you're doing, but for what I'm doing, I kind of,
it's
happening. So,
well, your music keeps evolving, right? And I wanted to congratulate you for the 25th anniversary. I mean, you were supposed to, from understanding, go on tour, but then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So how excited are you to be on the road, like touring now?
Yeah. So this tour, the Tempest 25 tour, was supposed to happen 2 years ago, as you said, mm-hmm. which would have been the 25th anniversary. Now it's the 27th anniversary. Like, is that a thing?
Oh, yeah.
To celebrate that? I don't know. But luckily I have a new record. So we're just calling it, call it whatever you want. Tempest 2, the Libre tour, whatever. We're on tour and we're happy on the road. But actually, it started, my first gigs this year started back in January. And they were in the States, where, you know, the States, I think, was much more, let's say, relaxed about COVID and all of that than we were up here. So things opened up much earlier. And we, as Canadian musicians, we kind of found it a bit disturbing when we went down, and, you know, like, to be in a hall full of people not wearing masks and doing a show was a bit of an adjustment for us. But, you know, we've been doing it. I think this is our sixth tour. I do these little 3-week tours. I try not to go out too long. So this is kind of the sixth one we've done this year. And by now we're starting to feel confident. Like, you know, several of the guys in the band have now had COVID like twice or three times. And then me, I somehow haven't had it at all. And, you know, I've been out in front of audiences night after night. I sort of figure if I was going to get it, I'd have got it by now. So, you know, I sort of feel like the vaccine worked in my case, because, you know, I normally get anything. You sneeze in my direction and I'm out for 3 weeks, you know. So, but anyway, just for me, the chance to kind of get back out and just play with other musicians, you know what I mean? To kind of, after 2 years of making music, you know, by yourself and recording things and playing on top of it, it's fun. It's not, you know, it's okay. But, you know, when I remember I was shooting a video with my friend Fetty towards the end of the pandemic, and he just like to be next to him somewhere, and we're playing and we're between takes, and I played something and he played something, he improvised something and I improvised something, and I was almost crying. I was like, oh my God, this was an unplanned musical moment, you know, that I didn't have to kind of record and plan. And so it was it's really nice. And then, of course, to be in front of an audience, like, audiences, it's a kind of a conversation. When you're an artist and you're up on stage, you play and they react, and it changes how you play the next note, you know what I mean? I always feel like every night is a little bit different, and a big part of that is the audience themselves. You know, people get up and start dancing during the show, changes how we play it, right? And I feel like you know, I'd really miss that. And it's funny, because you, after 25 years of touring, I to be truthful, I was probably taking it for granted. And then when that's taken away from you for 2 years, you don't take it for granted. You come back and you're like, oh, this is fantastic, I love this, you know. And so yeah, yes, happy to be back.
Yeah, because you miss it, right? And then, as you said, you're, you know, at home and recording now. Did you do everything, like record, edit, film, like the whole thing for this album?
Yeah, so, well, I've always made my albums at home. I've always produced them and engineered them. That's just how I do things. And in over the last, I don't know, 12 years or so, I've made my own music videos. And the very last PBS special, basically, it was just myself and a roadie in my band, who is a kind of a camera guy. Between the two of us, we set up cameras every day, framed everything every day, and shot one song on each venue of a Canadian tour, and turned it into a PBS special. And so I did all the editing. I did all the mixing. I helped, you know, set up the cameras and do the sliders and everything. And then he every day would come through with a sort of stabilized camera and do one handheld shot of that particular performance. And it was one of those things where during your introduction, you sort of said you added director to my list of what I do, and I really appreciate that, because part of me always feels like, well, I'm really a guitarist, and am I getting away with this? And then, you know, that show has been played nationally for several years now, and I guess I have to go, well, yeah, if I did direct it and edit it, so I guess I do that, you know. But there is that voice in the back of your head that always says, am I getting away with this? You know, are people accepting me? Is this? And I think it's that thing. You just if you have the courage to try. That is really ultimately,
So PBS specials, and you know, you do everything, right? And the directing, and so your music has evolved, but also you're so multi-talented. Do you think it helps you as to become even a better entertainer, a better musician, because you do it all, Jesse, right? And it's
thank you. Thank you. I don't know. That's a good question. Like, sometimes I envy people who don't get distracted by the other aspects, that they just they'll relegate. You know, they'll sort of go, okay, you know what? I'm going to hire a producer and hire an engineer and let somebody else mix it. I remember I was working on Nomad. This is quite a long time ago, back in, I don't know, 2005 or something like that. So, and that album took me 2.5 years, and I traveled all over the world. I was recording in London, I was recording in Cairo, I was recording in Los Angeles, I was all over the place, Toronto, of course. And I was, you know, I don't know how many months, I was 20 months into the project. And my manager, who also managed Diana Krall, said, you know, was talking to me on the phone. He said, oh, you know, Diana's going into the studio to start recording her new album. And I said, oh, well, wish her luck for me. And then I remember a few days later, we're talking on the phone. He goes, oh, yeah, she's finished that record. Just like, you know, my album, meanwhile, had sort of moved this much, you know, working around the clock. So I was like, you know what, maybe I don't do things the right way. Maybe I'm making this way too complicated, you know. But it is the problem. When you wear all those hats, sometimes you can be distracted. You know, I try to kind of compartmentalize, you know, when like I put on the guitarist hat and I sit down and try and just think about the guitar and not be thinking about, is this a good mic position, or how is this sitting with the arrangement, doing, you know, wearing the producer hat and trying to keep those hats off just long enough to play the guitar. But I do realize, like, when I'm working on a record, the guitar part is the part that gets the least amount of time, at least I put the least amount of work into, because you know, I've practiced so much in my life that I kind of go, oh, well, that's pretty good. And the producer kicks in immediately and goes, oh, well, we can do this and this and this. And sometimes, you know, I think if I was just a guitarist and I didn't have to wear those hats, I might, you know, just spend a lot of time thinking about just that performance. And maybe there'd be more that I bring to the performance. I don't know. Those are the questions I sort of wonder sometimes.
Yes.
You know, I wish I could do it somehow, some different way, but it just seems like, you know, this is how I like to work. So.
And you also have a singing cap too, because you don't say anything.
that's a job by necessity. It's not. So you know, as you probably know, years ago we covered or I covered Fall at Your Feet, I collaborated with a great singer named Danny Wilde from the Rembrandts. He's famous for singing the theme song to Friends, although his band actually had been a real band long before Friends. But anyway, it was just a one-time collaboration. It didn't make sense for him to come on the road with us just to sing one song. And over the years, different people have sung the song. Chris, the violinist in my band for years, would sing that song. And then when Chris left the band, I was like, well, who's going to sing the song now? And I sort of asked all the guys I was working with, do you sing? No, do you sing? No, you know, it's like, well, I guess it's going to be me. So I started taking vocal lessons, and it's hard. I have to say, it's the scariest part of the night for me, easily every night, is when I have to open my mouth and sing that song. And you know, I would not consider myself a vocalist, but I sort of, many of my heroes, I love Tommy Emmanuel's an amazing guitarist. I see his concerts. He's not a singer, but he'll sometimes just kind of sing a little song, like this is a beautiful melody and it's a song, and I don't have a great voice, but here it is. And or if you listen to, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, you know, some of those classic jazz albums, you know, he wasn't a singer, but he'd sing, you know, salt peanuts, like, and you could tell he didn't care. It was just the fun of singing a lyric. So I kind of hope, well, you know, it's in the spirit of that I, you know, I'll get up and sing a song every night, but most of the night it's really me playing the guitar, the only thing I really feel I'm actually qualified to do.